This series presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanations, but not necessarily the only ones, to the mysteries we will examine.
Hello, boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, friends, foes, whatever you are, doesn't matter. We'd like to welcome you to episode 20 of The Paranormal Pulse. My name is Lance Phillip, and with me, as always, my gorgeous co-host, Chris Bruno.
And as always, you make me blush, Lance.
There you go.
Welcome to Paranormal Pulse, the Paranormal Pulse podcast. We've episode 20. How cool. We made it to 20. Yay.
Absolutely.
We have some really good stuff tonight, too. I'm just going to run down the list. I'm not going to tell anybody anything interesting until we get there. But just so you have an idea of what's on the show tonight, we're going to talk about some interesting things happening at Lance's house recently. Probably because of the time of the year kind of increases activity. So we'll find out about that. We'll also talk about an interesting documentary that I had watched, and then Lance had watched it as well. And we're going to compare notes and talk about it. And you might like the subject matter. Has to do with a house out in, what was that, Long Island?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Next up, we will talk about a listener question applying to the Jersey Devil. You may have heard of that little thing. And lastly, we will talk about some other cryptids, regional cryptids. But first, we're going to get into the Paranormal Pulse and how you can listen to us and where. Obviously, you got to us this week, but that doesn't mean you know all of the ways that you can listen. And it's very exciting. We've got lots of ways to access the Paranormal Pulse podcast. You can listen to us on iTunes, on Roku, on Stitcher, on Podbean, on Blueberry, and of course, on Facebook. You can find us right there on the website. You can listen to the podcast from our Facebook page. It's called the Paranormal Pulse Podcast. We are also both part of a paranormal investigative group called EKG, East Coast Ghost, and you can find us on Facebook as well. Lastly, if you want to ring us, you know, give us a ring and ask us a question, we can take your voice and put it on the air with us. We've got our own line, our own question call line for all you listeners out there. You can call us through a Google number. Do you have that Google number, Lance? You know I never remember it myself because I don't call it.
There you go.
But I expect everybody else to.
All right. That phone number is area code 805-633-0935. Again, that's 805-633-0935.
You get a free pair of socks with that order.
Sure.
Sorry. Every time you do it that way, I always crack up thinking you're selling something on TV.
Well, can I? If it's an old pair of socks, I got some really dirty ones that they can have.
No. I didn't say dirty.
Oh, well, you know.
No. I don't think anybody wants a pair of dirty socks, unless they're paranormal.
They can
then
make sock
puppets. Buy all kinds of weird things.
Come on. They could do like, you know, make sock puppets and do little plays. You know, it'll be great.
Yeah. You can put it on that weird section on eBay.
There you go.
It looks like Lincoln. Anyway, welcome to the Paranormal Pulse podcast. I think we're going to get right into it, if that's cool with you, Lance. What do you think?
Absolutely.
Are you a god?
Hello, kiddies. This is Alice Cooper.
Hi, Welkers. This is Billy Idol.
Hey, this is Meatloaf.
Hey, this is Steven Tyler from Aerosmith.
I am Vince Clortho, key master of Gozer. Vulcan Sildrawer, Lord of the Sebulia. Are you the gatekeeper?
Hey, this is Grant Wilson of Ghost Hunters, and you're listening to the Paranormal Pulse.
This is the Paranormal Pulse.
All right, so basically this time of year, if you are into Halloween at all, and I'm assuming that if you're listening to us, you probably like the holiday just a little bit. You also know that there's a lot of history behind it, religious and otherwise. People do believe that around Halloween, which is technically a pagan new year, that the veil between the two worlds, between the living and the dead, is at its thinnest. It's like the wall between the two. So this is when it seems, and has been documented, I believe, that the most paranormal activity happens. And it can happen in your own home, depending on the history of that house or land or what have you, or even the energy that you have in your home or in the people in your home. So apparently our very own Lance Philip has been having some issues in your own home. And I would love for you to tell everybody about that.
Well, you know, we've talked about it on the show before. I've had a lot of activity here over the last few years, but all of a sudden the last 3 weeks or so, it's really ramped up. Just to give everybody just a quick background of what was going on prior, you know, as I've spoken about on the show prior, we've had the spirits of my former dog roam the house where we've seen it. We've heard barking. We've heard voices that say hello. We've had interesting interaction with a spirit that we call Betsy. In the house where things have moved and whatnot. I mean, just to give it a quick rundown. Well, activity had kind of quieted down for a while. About 3 weeks ago, I get up in the middle of the night and I hear a woman's voice. And again, it says, hello, coming from my kitchen area. Now, it's just me and my wife here. She's asleep in our bedroom. I'm up. You know, I go into the kitchen and there's nobody there. I figure, well, maybe it's my neighbor on the porch because we have upstairs neighbors. I look out, no one there. And again, it was a female's voice, very similar to the voices I had heard prior. I heard the voice over the next couple of days about three times. Again, always saying hello, like it's trying to get someone's attention.
Right.
Often my dog and my cat will look up and at the same time I hear the voice and kind of just stare. So it makes me wonder if they're seeing something I can't see. And I've talked about this before. I don't like ghost hunting in my own home, at least doing EVP sessions, because I'm always weary of if you hear a voice that says, I'm going to hurt you or I hate you or something where it's directly at myself or my wife.
Right, and you live there, so what do you do?
Exactly. So with that being said, I've never really done an EVP session, but I've done stuff with EMF meters, all kinds of other stuff, but... And if anybody knows me, they know my ghost hunting stuff is pretty much scattered in every room of the house, which my wife wants to kill me for, but that's just the way it is. Well, the other night, two strange things happened. I'll tell you the first one. I was sitting watching TV, and I have a laser pointer. Now, it's not one of the cheap laser pointers you find at Walmart. This is one of the really expensive ones that can put underlines under things. It was made for – when I used to do a lot of presentations and stuff years ago, I used it. And it could actually underline a whole sentence. It could, you know, just point the line. And it runs off of AAA batteries. It's not one of the ones that use the cheapy watch batteries. It's a really quality unit made by Radio Shack. And it has a switch on it that you have to hold down. It's a pressure switch. It's not one that you can press and lock it in place.
Right.
Well, I don't make presentations anymore, so I wind up using it to play with the cat and drive him nuts with it. So I have it sitting on my ottoman right next to my remote controls, my TV. Now, I was watching TV, and I fell asleep. I wake up, and the laser is on and pointing directly at right under my TV at the TV stand. And I said, holy cow. You know, I was like, holy cow, that thing's on. It shouldn't be on. I was like, because there's no way to lock it on. As soon as I reached for it to pick it up, the laser went off. So I looked at the switch to say, well, maybe I thought maybe the cat stepped on it or something. And I looked, but the switch was up. It was in the up position. It wasn't pressed down. So then I tried to take it and forcibly lock the button, like, you know, press it in ways it's not meant to be pressed. I couldn't get this thing to lock down. So I put it back down. And at this point now, I was awake after I, you know, had fallen asleep before. So I was awake. I was typing on the computer because I had my laptop in front of me. And I'm typing away. All of a sudden, I look up. And the laser's on again. Now I know. Now this time I know it's not the cat because he's sitting on my right and my dog is sitting on my left. And this thing's still on the ottoman. I reach down again to grab it. As soon as my hand gets near it, it turns off. I can't explain it. I tried again, tried to debunk it. I tried to play with the switch. I tried to lock in every which way. And I said, you know, why is this thing turning on? Couldn't figure out why for the life of me. There's just no explanation for why that thing went on. So... You know, a couple of days went by, and I totally forgot about it. Well, I didn't forget about it, but I just, you know, put it out of the back of my mind. It's not real, you know, don't know what it was.
You just discounted it and moved on with your day.
Right. Now, I will say, the one thing about my house is My wife's seen the activity. I've seen activity. But we've never seen it at the same time, with the exception of the very first time it ever manifested, which was a Christmas Eve going back 3 years ago now. That was the only time we've ever seen the activity at the same, you know, at the same time. Every other time it's been one of us individually. Well, the other night we're sitting watching TV, and I happened to just be looking. I just happened to turn and look at my wife, see what she was doing on the computer. And as I turned, I see a big ball of light moving across my window in the right of the room. Now, we have a big, giant 8-foot-long window that's got a big curtain over it. Now, for people who know, I'm a photographer. I do a lot of photo shoots in my house. And what I do is I move my furniture around. I actually shoot in my living room with all the backdrops, the lighting, and everything. Well, mm-hmm. I had the blackout. I use blackout curtains when I shoot because I don't like light spilling in from the outside. So I had all the blackout curtains over that window, so no light could get in from the outside. Well, I happened to turn, and when I saw the ball of light, Jen just saw it as well, because she looked at me and said, "Did you just see that?" And I said, "You're talking about the ball of light that just went across the curtain, you know, the window?" She goes, "Yeah, that's exactly what I saw." She goes, "Go inside, see if it went, you know, if it moved to the other room." Well, in running from where my living room is situated, right behind that is our bedroom. There's a wall that mm-hmm. separates them. So I was going basically just around from one doorway into another. But of course, there's my, you know, apartment's small, so there's my dining room table as into, you know, because that's the other room that's connected off the living room. And sure enough, I have an EMF meter sitting there. I grab a K2 meter. I go running. As soon as I hit the little hallway that's between the two rooms, it became frigid cold. And all of a sudden, I started getting EMF spikes. But I was like, well, you know, frigid cold, that just could be moving from one room to another, you know.
Have you tested that apartment before as far as the EMF
yes.
spikes?
Yes, and I know where all the activity is. There's
Yeah, because sometimes you have hot spots just from electrical
and,
wires.
Right, and I know right down further in that hallway, there is an electrical box. And right. you get really ridiculously high readings around that. But move 4 feet away sure. from it, you don't really get readings. And back about where I was, you don't get readings at all. Also, like I said, I was getting readings where I never got readings before. So because of the temperature, I just quickly ran back to the table, and I happened to have one of my ghost hunting bags there, and I pulled out the Melmeter. Turned it on, including with the REM pod on it, and went to the same area. Sure enough, I'm still getting spikes in EMF. But the temperature was at 60, 62 degrees right there, where the rest of the house was all at 72, between 72 and 73 degrees. And this happened, a good
10-degree drop.
Right, and this all happened quicker than I'm describing it.
Sure.
I quickly ran into the bedroom to see if the ball of light was in there. No ball of light in there, no EMF to be heard of. The temperature was, again, 10 degrees hotter in there. Came back out to where that spot was. All of a sudden, the EMF is gone. And the temperature is evened out with the other rooms.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Now, so just so you have a better grasp of the way the living room is situated, there's only the large window on the one wall. The other two walls are solid, like, you know, say north and south. And then the east wall, there is no real wall. It's open to the dining room, and then it's open to a little hallway, which leads to my front door. And there are two windows on that front door. So my first thought was, well, maybe it was just light coming in through that door. But I happened to look, and again, when I do my photo shoots, I like to shoot dark, meaning I like a dark room and then use the lighting from my strobe lights to light the scene as opposed to having natural light bleed in.
Right.
So I have covers that I put over those windows. Sure enough, I hadn't taken those covers down because I should say I had done a photo shoot that morning in the house. So all the camera equipment was still up, tripods, light stands, everything was up. And the only couch I moved back was the main couch. I hadn't moved the other one back. So there was no way light could have come in from the outside. So it was very weird, very, very hard to explain. And again, I wound up going around just for shits and giggles, taking EMF readings all around the place, getting all my baseline readings in order, and everything matched up to what I found in the past doing EMF readings, you know, where you would expect to find EMF around my computers, around my, you know, big screen TV and all that stuff. Sure enough, I was getting it around the outlets, you know, a couple of them that have power transformers, you know, coming out for powering various devices or whatever. you'd get the EMF, mm-hmm. but you didn't get it anywhere else. Sure enough, I went back to the area again where we got the EMF spikes, and nothing, nothing. Temperature was still where it should have been. So, you know, it's one of those things you don't want to say it's paranormal, but at the same time, I tried everything I could to debunk it, every which way I know how to debunk things, and I couldn't find a valid reason for a ball of light just to be there. And the fact that Jen saw it at the same time I did means that I wasn't hallucinating on this one. You know what I mean?
It's nice when you have somebody else to validate your experience.
So it was kind of a cool thing. You know, and like I said, we this time of the year is generally, over the last 3 years, every time we've had activity, it has been more November, December. So this is a little earlier than usual for us. And for some reason, it always manifests, you know, November, December.
Surprised it's so late for you there. If, you know, activity is really supposed to be strongest around the week of October, beginning of November, and then it starts to peter out again.
And, you know, the thing is, we've done history. We've searched out the history of the place. You know, I live in a large complex. Yeah. You know where I live. It's a large complex.
Yeah.
Before it was a complex, it was farmland. And there's really not a lot of history, but I did find in some of the records that the name that we associate with the spirit, we call her Betsy. In doing the research, there was a Betsy who was on the property prior. And it was very weird because the reason why we call her Betsy is because we had used the obelisk going back 3 years ago, and that was the name it spit out at us. So we just always called her Betsy. Ironically, in doing the research, there was a Betsy who was on the property, and she was a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have much more information than that. You know, it's hard. There's not a lot of records of, you know, because it was such a big farm property. You know, there's not a lot of specific records. So, but we did find it was a Betsy, and she lived with her husband. And unfortunately, I'm drawing a blank on the husband's name. But we had heard the husband's name spoken before.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes, and that matched up with what we found in the records. So. It's always been an interesting place. It's actually been really good to work on, you know, some of the ghost hunting equipment, because I've been able to do some live testing that some people don't have that luxury of doing, you know.
Yeah.
So use it to validate things, and you know, some of the you know, homemade equipment that I've used, I've put into effect here and gotten some good results. So, but that's where we're at. So I'll keep everybody updated as, you know, as things go by, if we hear more activity or can even catch things. I mean, I actually just picked up a camera very inexpensively. It was like a $200 camera. I picked it up for like $25 off of Amazon used. And I'm going to do a conversion on that to make it full spectrum. So to go along with the one full spectrum camera I already have. But I'm going to start taking some photos with that, see if we can catch anything, you know.
And what's interesting, you do a lot of customization on some of your equipment, and you show people how to do it as well, or how you did it online at YouTube. You have your own YouTube channel if people wanted to subscribe and see what about the equipment that you've been talking about and your experience this past week. What's the YouTube channel name again?
It's Ghost Hunter 617.
So you can go on to YouTube and just follow that channel or subscribe or whatever they call it there.
Right. There's a lot of tech stuff on there. There's a lot of there's actually a lot of stuff from our investigations over the last few years that's up there. So
yeah. So it's a nice resource for how to use some of the equipment, what are the good and bad about them, and actually some of them in use, which is kind of cool.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, well, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of listeners out there, too, that have had personal experiences. That's why I think most people that I talk to that are involved in the paranormal in some way, shape, or form had some sort of experience, personal on their own, one-on-one experience, which makes them not doubt the whole possibility of these things anymore. Some are more emotionally involved, more sensitively involved, and some of them are like us, where we're more about the logical and scientific end. I want to prove it.
Right.
So I want some hard evidence, and that's what you'll find on our YouTube channel. We were also watching, because this was an interesting story, and of course it's all about perspective and what you believe in. Amityville Horror, a lot of people remember the movie that was done. This was based on a true story by a lot of different people's recounts of what happened back in 1975 to the Lutz family. After they moved into a home, that was supposedly haunted by a family that was murdered, the whole family. It was a very scary and sad story, and what happened next when the Lutz family moved in was just as is equally as frightening, at least in the movies. What we watched was a documentary done in 2012, so just last year. It was the first time in 35 years that Daniel Lutz, he was one of the family members that had moved into the Amityville home, he recounts his version of what happened. He talks to some of the reporters that were back on the case back then when he was experiencing these things. They were talking about some of the investigators that went in. And it's all in this documentary called My Amityville Horror. And I watched it on Netflix. Bored one day, went, oh, hey, I know that house. And I watched the documentary. And then Lance and I were talking about it the one time. And he said, hey, you know, is that on Netflix? I'm like, yep. So he went and watched it himself. So we're just going to chat about Amityville, this house on Ocean Avenue. I don't think it exists on Ocean Avenue anymore, but very interesting. And Daniel Lutz's recount of it 35 years later, my reaction to the way he behaved really puts me on alert. I don't know. What do you think, Lance? You've got anything to add to that intro of information?
See, his behavior doesn't surprise me. He's a typical New York guy. He's just like half the people I grew up with, and that's no exaggeration.
Mm.
So that honestly, that behavior didn't really surprise me, because that's the type of blue collar New York people that you meet. I also believe, in my opinion, that he does believe what he's talking about.
Oh, sure.
I think in his mind, everything's the way he says it is.
Well, I have to say, just by you phrasing it that way shows me that you don't believe everything he says.
I don't know. No, it's not that. Not that I don't believe him.
We're not doubting that he believes.
Well, what I do believe, like, you know, they had that one psychologist in there who is saying that, if you remember the part, she talks about whether it really happened or is it him recalling it because he heard his parents talking about it. And he's making his stories fit to what they had said because he was such a young child at that point.
Right.
You know, and I wonder how much of it was suggestion, power of suggestion, which we've talked about mm-hmm. before. I don't know.
I got a lot of, I also grew up with a lot of New York guys, so I'm not immune to that. I know the deal. But just beside that, if you extract that from his behavior and look at his actual behaviors, in some instances, he was extremely defensive of his thoughts and what he believes is true. Now, we're not saying that he's not believing that it didn't happen in his head, but extremely defensive, does not want to hear anything else.
I
think that he had a lot of, he's a little off kilter, in my opinion. And I'm not saying that if the experience was truly, truly happened, that would set anybody off kilter.
Well,
but
the thing about him being
his recollection of it, mm-hmm. the timelines don't work all the time. You know, he says he was out on his own at a certain point, but in the timeline that would have made him 10 years old. So I have a little bit of difficulty on some of his facts.
Well, the whole thing is, that's the whole problem with the whole case in general. A lot of the timeline, just forgetting even him, just a lot of the timeline of the events don't add up. Since I watched a documentary, you know, by my own admission, I didn't know enough about the case to make a judgment either way. So I did a lot of reading after the fact, after I watched it the other day, and really read a lot. Like in one day, I just spent hours reading about it. And
right. There's
a lot of things that don't add up, but, you know.
Yep. And there's no question that he dislikes George Lutz.
Hates George
Lutz. Not just
Lutz.
Dislikes. Hates, despises, is thrilled that he's dead.
Yes.
And makes it very clear in his documentary.
Right, exactly. You know,
now that negativity alone is enough.
Right. And, you know, and there's so much, I don't know, there's so many things with the facts of the case that, you know, you could just go over. You know, for people who don't know, let's just kind of, I'm going to run down some of the claims that were made. Okay.
Sure. Of the house after the crime, correct?
Right. This is what the Lutzes were claiming, okay? George would wake up at 3:15 every morning and would go out to check the boathouse. They later learned that was the estimated time of the DeFeo killings. Weird? Is that something that somebody could have looked up and known the time and just claimed it?
Absolutely.
Probably. You know, they...
Well,
they,
I don't know. When was the year that this happened? The 70s? This was before the internet.
True, but death records were public.
True.
You know.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, you know, with your timeline, because I'm looking up the details of the crime itself,
right,
so people know without being you know, too gory.
They claim the house was plagued by swarms of flies despite being in the winter. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy, the mother, had vivid nightmares about the murders and discovered the order in which they occurred in the rooms that they took place. The Lutz children also began sleeping on their stomachs that they had never done before, which is the same way that the bodies were found, all on their stomachs.
Mm-hmm.
Kathy would feel a sensation as if she were being embraced in a loving manner by an unseen force. George discovered a small hidden room about 4 by 5 feet behind shelving in the basement. The walls were painted red, and the room did not appear in the blueprints of the house. The room came to be known as the Red Room, and the room had a profound effect on the dog Harry, who refused to go near it and cowered as sensing something ominous. There were cold spots and odors throughout the house of perfume and excrement in areas where no wind drafts or piping could explain the source. Let's see. Now, while tending the fire in the fireplace, George and Kathy saw the image of a demon with half his head blown out, as if shot, and it supposedly was burned into the soot in the back of the fireplace. The Lutz's daughter, Missy, developed an imaginary friend named Jody, a demonic pig-like creature with glowing red eyes, which, if you remember, in the documentary, Daniel talks about that, being outside and looking up into her window and seeing the pig face with the red eyes. It says that's the other. George would wake up with the front door slamming, race downstairs, and find the dog sleeping soundly by the front of the door. Nobody else ever heard the sound, although it was loud enough that it should have awakened everybody in the house. George would also hear what he described as a German marching band tuning up, and the sound of a clock radio playing not on frequency. When he went downstairs, the noise would cease. George also realized that facially he bared a strong resemblance to Ronald DeFeo Jr. and began drinking at the Witch's Brew Bar, where DeFeo once was a regular customer. Now, here's the ironic thing about that, because, well, we'll go back to what they debunk out of this stuff.
Yeah, probably a ton.
Well, yeah, when closing Missy's window, which Missy said Jody climbed out of, Kathy saw the red eyes glowing back at her. While in bed, Kathy received red welts on her chest caused by an unseen force and was levitated 2 feet in the air. Then they claim locks and doors, windows in the house were damaged by an unseen force. Then they claim cloven footprints attributed to an enormous pig appeared in the snow outside the house on January 1st, 1976. They also claim...
Sounds like they had a good New Year's Eve.
Yeah, right? Then it claims that a green gelatin-like slime oozed from the walls and hall, and also from the keyhole in the playroom door in the attic. Then they also claim a 12-inch crucifix hung on the living room by Kathy revolved until it was upside down and gave off a sour smell. Then it says, George tipped over a 4-foot-high China lion ornament in the living room and found bite marks on his ankles. Weird. George saw Kathy transform into an old woman of 90, the hair wild and shocking white, and the face a mass of wrinkles with ugly lines and saliva dripping from a toothless mouth. They spoke about that in the documentary.
Right.
And last but not least, it says Missy would sing constantly while she was in her room. Whenever she left the room, she would stop singing, and upon returning, would resume singing right where she left off. Now, in doing some of the research, I'm reading that some of the things that they've kind of debunked was, first of all, the bar that supposedly George became a regular customer didn't exist. There was no bar called the Witch's Brew.
There was one called Henry's.
Right. But there was none called the Witch's Brew. Also, the cloven footprints attributed in the snow outside January 1st, 1976, when they researched, there was no snow January 1st, 1976. So there's things in this story that they find holes with, you know. And then even Father Mancuso, who supposedly went there, and if you remember, Daniel in the documentary talks about remembering the priest entering the house.
Yeah.
Well, he claims he never advised them other than anything on the telephone. But even that, which that's what he claims now, but even that can be debunked because he was on an episode of In Search Of, hosted by Leonard Nimoy. They interviewed him on there where he said he went into the house. So his story has changed. That's why there's so much going on with this. It's hard to figure out what's truth, what's not. And then the thing about it that's even more amazing is that George and Kathy took lie detector tests and passed them.
Right.
You know, so obviously.
But again, they believe that these things really actually happened.
But even with that being said, at this point, you know, lie detectors are like 99% accurate.
It's as long as that person believes is the truth, they can pass it.
I've done a lot with because my old company used to use lie detectors. Mm-hmm. You can even believe it and still fail because inside there's a way that your body can't fool it, the system.
I'm sorry. If you're delusional, and people have learned to fool the system, if you're delusional and you believe that something is 100% true, you can't put off that physical response to reject it, to make it seem like you're lying.
It's not a physical response, so it's a subconscious result. That's the thing. Like I said, I've done a lot with it because I had to go through a couple of lie detector tests for old companies for incidents that took place where they gave lie detector tests to the whole company. And I did a lot of research on it. It's like one in a million people that can pass a lie detector test. It's such a small ratio. That's why at this point, they're getting very close to making them admissible in court. You know, now, maybe back then, the lie detectors may not have been as sophisticated as they are now. I don't know. That's what I don't know. You know, but it's not they've proven it's not a physical thing. It's a psychological, and the effects on your body. You know, the percentage of accuracy is incredible now. But, and I mean, that's neither here nor there. The fact that they did pass it is interesting, because even if you want to go with the fact that they believe that it happened, would just go to prove that they're not necessarily lying. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I don't know. It's very, like, I don't know which way to go in this case. I don't know if it's a hoax, if it's not, or like anything else, that there might be some basis in fact that it was greatly exaggerated. I mean, even George Lutz, before he passed away, said that he basically claimed that the media blew what was the events out of proportion. And that he,
of course,
you know, and that they didn't exaggerate to that,
that
point.
That shouldn't be
but
a surprise.
Here's the thing, though. And this is what you have to look at. George and Kathy Lutz never made a dime off of this. The author of the book, Jay Anston, made a ton of money off of it.
Yeah.
But they, Anston, I should say, but they never had anything to gain financially.
And no, he just got fame. He's the guy in the Amityville house. They touched on that in the mm-hmm. documentary as well. At least Daniel's point of view is that George loved it, and he used to introduce himself as the guy from that house.
Yes, yep.
So he got what he wanted out of it, mm-hmm. whether it was monetary or not is a whole other story.
Right.
And I'm not saying that he was lying. I'm just saying that there's a lot of contributing factors that are, askew. They have the whole thing in there about the fact that he was very into the occult.
Right.
Not saying that that's going to cause anything or not cause anything, whether they could prove it or not. But it certainly would give him fodder for his imagination as to what he would want to tell people for mm-hmm. shock value or what have you. This was back in 1975, 1976. The murders were 1974. So it was still fresh in everybody's minds.
Right. You know, and also, too, that the thing about the original book, too, is the book changed it with different versions that were printed. A mm-hmm. lot of the facts were changed within the book itself.
Well, sure. And he can change it to do whatever he wants with it. Makes a good movie.
Right. No. It's just that was some of the criticism behind the book, too, is that they felt that the storyline basically follows the same storyline as The Exorcist in a way. And it's very interesting. I mean, there's a lot, like, if you just go into reading the whole criticism of it, you know, there's a lot behind that. And some of it makes sense. Some of it's a little off the wall as well, you know. I tell you, though, like, I did, like, as far as the documentary go, I did enjoy the part of it where they spoke to Lorraine Warren at her home.
Yeah.
Lorraine Warren is obviously, she is one of the most highly respected authorities on demonology in the field. Everybody who's in the field knows who she is, refers to her at some point or another, or her writings or somebody she's worked with, whether it be, you know, John Zaffis or, you know, or countless others. You know, she's been on Ghost Hunters, she's been on Ghost Adventures, and she's been on all those shows, obviously Paranormal State. They all go mm-hmm. to her for advice. And it was just so weird because the way I see her in that, like, I think of this older woman who's a, you know, staunch demonologist. And then they go to her house and she's like every little old grandmother I've ever met. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes.
And it's kind of...
She's a little kooky. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, she's very strong-minded in what she does. And, mm-hmm. and as she should be, I mean, she's been studying it for most of her life. And so when they go into the basement to talk more, there's a lot more of her
right.
demonology side.
Oh yeah,
showing
between the skulls in the top, and
when
everything
we first
else.
Walked into her house with her plants and her pets,
right?
It was very, very kooky grandma,
right? And that's it was so weird because I was like, that's not a side of the woman. Now, obviously, I've never met the woman. I've only seen stuff that she's written about. I've seen her interviewed and whatnot. And all of a sudden, I had a whole like, I thought of this, you know, this older woman out there fighting the devil. And now all of a sudden I think of her as like somebody's nice grandma, you know?
Yeah, she's got some interesting knickknacks in her home. And just an interesting person in general. Good history to look up about her. You can find that stuff online. We're talking about My Amityville Horror. It's a documentary that was done in 2012. Speaking to Daniel Lutz, one of the previous people that lived in the house during the whole Amityville hauntings, only a couple years after the murders took place. And My Amityville Horror, the documentary, is the first time in 35 years that Daniel talks about it to filmmakers and reporters and that type of thing. So it was an interesting perspective.
Kind of, I tell you, he's an interesting guy, you know. He's very gruff, you know. I mean, He drops the F word like it's going out of style, you know.
Yeah, know that it isn't something that you can watch with your kids if they, you know, if they're younger, because he drops the F bomb every other word. He's very defensive.
He's also very angry.
So angry right. all the time about everything, and I think that's what sets him off. He's a little off kilter.
Well, even like the being defensive, I can understand. You know, because for years they've had the accusations that he's. You know, I guarantee you there are people who just constantly bombard him with, you know, are you lying? Are you lying? And after a while, you know, 30-something years, you get tired of it. So you would be definitely defensive,
right.
at least in my opinion. I know I would have been. But
it wasn't so much his recount of the events as much as his current modern-day behavior that puts me off on believing everything he says. Mm-hmm. You know, especially with his whole timeline of I wasn't home at that point or I was out on my own. He was very quiet about where he went or who he was with after that fact. He was just not home with them.
Right.
And at the age that he's saying he did it, I don't know. I'm not buying it completely. I think there's some bits and pieces that are being intentionally left out.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that. There's definitely some things that just don't add up.
They don't add up.
But overall, I mean, I don't know. I honestly don't know what's a lie, what's not a lie, what's, you know, just problems in recall necessarily,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, it is 35 years later.
Right.
And any person, they've proven this in all kinds of psychological testing and stuff, that any person can convince themselves of something actually happening at some point that was not necessarily an event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you ever see that show Brain Games?
Yeah, absolutely.
And how your brain tricks yourself because of what's going on around them. It happens every day. Our recounts are not 100% effective. And 35 years later, come on.
Right.
And how can he possibly be accurate about the timeline or anything else?
Right. And just so
he believes it.
Yeah, and just so people know, because I've actually, if you look at my Facebook page and I've posted it on our EKG page, I've actually been out in front of that house. It looks much different today than it did then. Mm-hmm. Gone are the, you know, are the iconic windows. They've replaced them with square windows. They've changed the color of the house. They've done everything to make it not look like the Amityville Horror House, and they've even changed the street addresses there. So. Because they were trying to discourage people like myself from going and standing in front of the place and taking photos and whatnot.
Right, because this isn't a crappy neighborhood. This
is
a high-end neighborhood, right on the water.
Right, it's million-dollar homes there. You know, it's not it's not, you know, your middle class neighborhood. It's an upper class neighborhood. You can go by there, you see the expensive cars and all the driveways, you know. And what'll happen now is security will come and chase you away pretty quickly. The day I was there, we were only there for a few minutes, just enough for me to get about 10 pictures in front of the place. And then we got out of there really quick. My stepbrother doesn't live too far from there. He'd give me a heads up on, you know, when to go and this, that, the other thing. So the long and short of it is that when they went to make the movies, the house had already been changed. So they made the movies in New Jersey. And eventually that home had people stopping by constantly taking photos. And they did the same thing with that home, where they've now changed the way the home looks to discourage people from stopping, which I found really interesting.
Well, those little kind of quarter moon windows ended up being very iconic. And they were very 70s.
Right.
You know, a lot of the houses from the 70s, especially the ones that had some sort of view, they used those windows on. And a lot of them have been switched out since. So, yeah, I think that Amityville definitely had an influence on the market for those, too.
Well,
but just a very quick background
on
the house before they moved in. I'll just go over it very quickly. It was the DeFeo family, the older brother Butch was his nickname. His name was Ronald. They used to call him Ronnie. Basically went into his home. He was 23 years old, November 13th, 1974. Went into the home around 3 a.m. and killed everybody in his family in their beds. There were six people, his mother, his father, and the one sister. Dawn was 18, Allison was 13, Mark was 12, John Matthew was 9. And, of course, the parents were only 43 and 42. And he was a little... there was something definitely wrong with Ronnie, and you can find more about the Amityville house that was at 112 Ocean Avenue, no longer there, online at our Facebook page, at our Paranormal Pulse podcast page. Also, the documentary that we're talking about is My Amityville Horror, talking with Daniel Lutz for the first time in 35 years. You wanted to add something else there, Lance?
No, not really. I think you know, we hit on a lot of it. I mean, I just wish I knew a lot more, and I tried to get a guest for the show who would really have been able to shed a lot of light on. Unfortunately, that person's schedule didn't really jive with what we were doing, so I'm hoping in the future to get that person on board. You know,
we'll revisit it then.
Oh, absolutely, because I think there's so much more than
There's a lot about this, and it's been researched over and over and over again over all these years.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice, the past 36 years, 37 years since the killings. So
yeah, and what I do find is that people who you talk to have very definite opinions. They're either in favor of it or against. There's very little in-between ground, you know, I'm finding. I also found it interesting that, you know, growing up in New York City like I did, that the main reporters there were from Fox 5 News in New York. And the
that was when Fox was fairly new.
Right, and the main reporter there, I forget his name, but... I that guy I've seen on the news for years until he left. I think he retired now, but he was on the news for years and years, and he was very famous in New York. And I'm just drawing a blank on his name, but it was interesting to see him because I was like, I know that guy. I've watched that guy on the news for years, so I felt very comfortable when him speaking it. You know,
right? And you'll see in the documentary as well that the reporters, not all of them were buying the stories they were getting either.
Right.
But again, it's called My Amityville Horror. You can find it actually on Amazon. You can watch it from Amazon, I believe, as well. You can also not watch it on Netflix streaming, just like we did. And let us know what you think. We were happy to hear your comments. You can comment on our Facebook page, Paranormal Pulse Podcast, right on the wall. Shoot us a message. Or you can call us on our Google hotline, our listener hotline, with a question or a comment about the Amityville Horror house and documentary. What's that number, Lance?
It's 805-633-0935. Yes, that's right. 805-633-0935. You're the next contestant on The Price is Right.
You need to say it like faster, really, really fast, and say it like three times, and then we can... throw in some complimentary pencils or something. I don't know.
If I say three times, the Beetlejuice appear.
Yeah. Or the Candyman.
You know. on a total different topic before we take a little break, I had a great time.
I think we should take a break.
Well, just it's only a 2-second thing. I had such a great time the other day. I watched Ghostbusters 1 and 2. Mm-hmm. I love those movies. I'm going to leave it at that, and we'll take a little break.
Okay.
All righty.
Just relax. We are now checking your paranormal pulse.
Welcome back to the Paranormal Pulse podcast, episode 20. Hooray, we hit 20, Lance. Can you believe that?
Absolutely.
Episode 20, I'm sure you're listening to us from some sort of exciting method, but just to recap all the ways that you can listen to the Paranormal Pulse podcast, you can listen to us, find us on Facebook, first off. That's the best way to find us and listen to us right from the Facebook page. You can listen to us from your Blueberry or Roku or Stitcher or Podbean or iTunes. And there's lots of mobile ways to listen to us through those methods. And last but not least, you can always call us with one of your listener questions. We'll be so happy to hear from you. We'll even put you on the air. We'd love to get listener questions from you guys. And do your hawking whatever goods today. What's the number, Lance?
It's 805-633-0935. 805-633-0935.
See?
There you go.
One more.
805-633-0935.
See, that's more like the ads. Good job. Good
there
job.
You know.
So anyway, so we're getting back into our subjects of the evening. And there's one subject that just kind of morphs into the other, pardon the pun. And it all stems from a listener question that you got, Lance.
Yeah,
from, well, who's the listener?
It's Kenny from Brooklyn.
Okay.
And what it was is I posted a poster of the Jersey Devil on the Paranormal Pulse website.
Yeah, we are Jersey.
Absolutely. Kind of a cool poster. It had a picture, you know, a drawing of the Jersey Devil, and it had an explanation as to what he is.
Can I read it? I'll read the explanation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jersey Devil, a supernatural creature that resides in dark forests or graveyards. Its origin is clouded by urban legend, but what is certain is it is dark in nature. Appearing at night, this beast stalks those who are alone for many days before snatching them. Never to be seen again. This needs more commas. There is no known vanquish. Okay, and then it just trails off.
Right.
Well, there you go. And it's got a story from the Pine Barrens area of New Jersey.
Right. Well, the whole key is that, you know, Kenny had asked, do I believe the Jersey Devil is real? And honestly, as much as he's New Jersey's top cryptid, I there's too much there, too much folklore wrapped up into it, and that I just don't believe it's real. Plus, I also feel that very strongly that it might be a case of mistaken identity. And what I mean by that is there is a large bat that is known by two names. It's known as the Pemba Flying Fox or the Bismarck Flying Fox. And it hails from Tanzania, where it has become an epidemic. This thing is large. It's considered in the class of mega bats. This thing is one of the world's largest bats. And it has a fox's face, which is what the Jersey Devil is described as having. A dog's head with bat wings. So it would be very easy for someone to see this thing and, you know, and easily confuse it with a Jersey Devil. And I know I've read that they've been imported into this country illegally. So what's to say it hasn't been set free? We have all kinds
or broke loose, whichever.
Right. Right, and they are in zoos. I've seen them in zoos. These things are huge. So I've always felt that's a very logical explanation. Now, these things are not that they're giant size, but they're about, you know, they're about 12 inches tall, you know, and they're about two pounds or so. So they're a large, you know, they're a large, you know, creature.
Right.
So, you know, with that kind of look, it could easily scare somebody into thinking it's a Jersey Devil. I mean, you know.
Sure. I mean, the recounts of this, though, I mean, a bastard child that was birthed in the Pine Barrens, I think, was one of the stories.
Right.
You know, the son of a devil or what have you, or some cursed woman. I there's so many different variations of the stories of why the Jersey Devil exists.
You know, so that's basically my summary of what I think it is. But it leads us to a new fun segment that we're going to do on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And since we are in New Jersey, based out
of
New Jersey.
Yeah, we're Jersey. Yeah.
Now, mind you, I'm not native to New Jersey. I was born in New York, but I've become a Jersey person.
You're a transplant. I've been here my whole life. And I want to add just one little note that anybody that lives in New Jersey, as I do my entire life, doesn't refer to New Jersey as Jersey. Only outsiders do that.
Well, that's fine.
We here in New Jersey, we go down the shore. We don't refer to it as Joy-Z. We don't appreciate the comments of what exit do you live off of, because it doesn't work like that. Not for real.
Well, you know,
But the Jersey Devil,
I still
that's instilled in us from childhood. I was telling Lance the other day when we were over at Starbucks doing some planning that I remember as a child being in New Jersey, you know, going to school in New Jersey as a child. And I'd say it was probably second or third grade. One of our class projects was drawing or sculpting or paper macheing a Jersey Devil and putting it on display. And when we had a back to school night type thing, people came through and saw all these kids' different renditions of the Jersey Devil. So it's in our culture in the state. It's not just a paranormal thing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Hell, they named the hockey team after it.
Yeah, go Devils.
There you go. yeah, okay. Hey.
We're not getting on that.
I'm still New York.
That would just prove that you're not a Jersey person.
I'm still an Islanders fan, you know?
You don't have to be. There's plenty of us.
That's fine. You know.
So then this leads us to our new subject that you were just talking about, cryptids in New Jersey,
absolutely,
aside from the Jersey Devil.
What we've kind of decided to do is kind of every few shows run by a new cryptid that you may not have heard of that is from New Jersey, or at least seen in New Jersey.
Right.
So we're going to start this week, and, you know, this is because, again, not everybody knows about the cryptids in New Jersey, and so we're gonna discuss one of them today.
Okay.
And this one is the Hoboken Monkey Man. And I was wondering, Chris, if you had ever heard about this, being here your whole life. This thing first emerged in the 1980s, October of 1982 to be exact.
I have not.
Okay, well, let me enlighten you a little bit, and everybody else.
Enlighten me, please.
There you go. The so-called Hoboken Monkey Man emerged in October of 1982, and rumors had circulated throughout the Hoboken school system of a bizarre ape-like creature who was terrorizing students. It became known as the Hoboken Monkey Man, and it was alleged to be half man, half monkey. And supposedly this cryptid worked in school hallways, attacked children on their way home from school, and actually threw students out of windows, and it was even accused of killing a teacher. The hysteria got so bad that over 2 weeks that the Hoboken Police Department set up a task force to investigate the rumors.
That's pretty funny all on its own.
Yeah, and the Public Safety Council was called to help squash the children's fears. But as they investigated, basically all the inquiries came to a dead end, where they just couldn't find any student who had actually seen the Monkey Man, nor was there any teacher who was killed. And every type of story was, oh, I heard it from a friend of a friend, and that sort of thing, you know. Again, the police couldn't find anybody who had actually been attacked. The story had spread like wildfire. So eventually,
there's a lot of people from down that way, though, that have heard it, like you said, from a friend. So it's just been perpetuated over the years in South Jersey because of, you know, oh, I heard this guy is friends with my sister's husband's cousin, whatever.
Well, also keep in mind the time of the year. It was October. Halloween time. Possibly a mask. Who knows? We'll get to that in a second. But what had happened was the Public Safety Council finally had to announce that there is no Monkey Man, no students or children were missing. We went looking for him, and he wasn't even in the streets. How do you stop a rumor from growing like wildfire? And eventually the rumor did stop, and basically it died down right after Halloween.
Yep.
But here's the ironic...
Amazing how that happens.
Well, here's the ironic thing, though, is that later there were reports of this same Monkey Man appearing in Bayonne, and...
Did somebody move?
No, but the thing is, this story actually changed. And what it was is that there was on 9th Street in Bayonne, it's a dead-end block. And at the end of the dead end, there's a hill that goes down to the bay, and there's a fence there. And behind that fence is an old PT boat factory. And supposedly, there was a man who lived there who people referred to as the Monkey Man. He was, you know, supposedly this big hairy guy who dressed in a green shirt and green pants, and he would be found wandering, harassing the children through the neighborhood, and he became also known as the Monkey Man.
Okay.
There were also reports by another woman who basically said that she was looking out her window and she saw a man in janitor's clothes sweeping. And when she looked up at his face, he had a monkey's face and monkey's arms. And this happened in Bayonne. Now, even before that, okay, in 2001, this is where it gets really interesting. Over in India was another report of a monkey man, very similar to the one in Jersey, who would go out and harass kids. And again, and this thing was reported to be a 4 or 5 foot tall ape man, and he was going out harassing people through the streets of Ghaziabad, which is basically 22 miles north of New Delhi. And It got to the point where there were attacks by this giant monkey, and it led to a huge media event, and it swept throughout all India, and there were more than 100 articles written about it, and more than a dozen people actually did wind up hospitalized with fractures and severe injuries as a result of these attacks. But most of them got hurt in falls while running away from the thing. Yeah, exactly. So it gets really
They're panicking themselves. We were talking about that, too, the other day.
Mm-hmm.
People get themselves so worked up that they make it, they're their own worst enemy. This happens over and over and over again, not just in incidents like this, but in investigations as well. It's just they're ridiculous. You need to control yourself, for God's sake.
Well, it gets
imagination.
Well, it gets even more interesting because what had happened was the New Delhi police wound up getting involved, and they actually put out police artist sketches of the Monkey Man, and they went out on a giant manhunt, and of course, you know, or in this case, monkey hunt, and it was never found. Eventually, you know, the rumors died down, and you know, but this is what's really weird. Just a few years ago, two park rangers back here in New Jersey. Okay, reported a slightly less urban monkey man near the Atlantic County Park in New Jersey, right off of Route 50. What the two park rangers described was an anthropod ape-like creature crossing the road. At first glance, it sounded like a big. At first glance, people would think, well, it's a Bigfoot sighting, but no, this thing was much smaller. They were talking about this thing being. Yeah, and the park rangers are actually...
No, it's smaller than a Bigfoot. Like, they've had an actual account of that as well.
Well, you know, but what we all know what a Bigfoot's supposed to be. I mean,
no, it's just hysterical.
Right, absolutely.
No, it's like between a Bigfoot and a Wookiee.
Well, the thing about it is that you know, they say it was only about 4 feet tall, the size of a smaller man, and again, half man, half monkey without a tail. Now
that's a hairy man.
Now here's the thing. There have also been several reports of the monkey man at the Belkaville munitions plant that's been abandoned for years. Supposedly this thing was living in there. And there was an old cow barn there where it's supposedly living. And that
it's great for homeless people.
Well, and the cow barn supposedly was kept immaculately clean even though it was abandoned. Well, now when you go there, it's all overgrown. And what they're claiming is the people who live in the area, the locals, believe that it's because the creature died. So that's why it's not being maintained anymore. So that's basically...
Well, then maybe somebody should go back there and find out.
Absolutely. But that's basically the story of our Hoboken Monkey Man.
All righty.
So, I hope...
There's a lot of holes in that one.
What cryptid doesn't have a lot of holes? Let's be honest about this.
I know.
You know, but
true. That is true.
It's an interesting.
So a new one for you guys to look up and look into, especially anybody who lives in New Jersey and Southern New Jersey. This is your legend. This is your cryptid in Southern New Jersey.
There you go.
Feel free to take a look on our Paranormal Pulse podcast page and see what we may post up there about the Hoboken Monkey Man.
Absolutely. That's what I got. I hope everybody enjoyed that new little segment on New Jersey cryptids, and we're going to have more as we go on. So I've got a bunch.
Yes. Yeah, there's plenty of them, believe it or not. All kinds of legends and ghost stories, of course. Weird New Jersey is an excellent resource for you on those, too. So I think we've hit all notes, all moments of joy in the show today. If you'd like to get in contact with us, we are always around. I'm online all the time, Chris Bruno. You can find me online, linked up to the Paranormal Pulse podcast page on Facebook. You can listen to our podcast streaming from Blueberry, from Facebook, from Podbean, which is a great place to go. That's our homepage of the podcast, and we have all kinds of links and resources and little kind of blurbs of information all there, more than the Facebook page. Stitcher, great way to listen to our podcast streaming. Roku and iTunes for you Apple users. We are available on iTunes. You can take us with you anywhere you want to go. You can check out our team page too, EKG. We're East Coast Ghost, East Coast with a K, Ghost on Facebook, and check out what kind of investigations we're going to be working on. And last but not least, of course, the YouTube page, where Lance does a whole lot of techie stuff and demonstrates some of the neat toys that he gets a hold of and some of the modifications he makes on his own equipment, as well as some bits and pieces of investigations that EKG has been on. That's available at YouTube. Subscribe to our YouTube page. That's Ghost Hunter. What's
Ghost Hunter number? 617.
So 617. Yep. Ghost Hunter 617 on YouTube. Follow it, subscribe to it, do whatever you have to do.
And also,
it's a good resource.
I've just got two quick little plugs.
Okay.
And they are, you folks can follow me on Twitter. I tweet.
Oh, that's right. You're doing the whole tweet thing, too.
Yeah, I do a decent amount of tweetering, not as much as some people. Some people tweetering? Live on there. Yeah, that's what I guess.
Tweeting?
Tweeting, that's it.
Like a bird?
Right, sure. So you can find me on Twitter at LancePhilipEKG, all one word. LancePhilipEKG. That's Philip with one L, by the way.
Right.
On Twitter, you can follow me, and if you follow me, I'll probably follow you back because I do a lot of following.
Because that's what he does.
Yeah, it's great, and you can follow my conversations with some of the people you've heard on this show, and then you can also find me on Facebook at Lance Philip. Again, yeah. Philip with one L. Reach out to us because we'll be more than happy to talk to you on there and answer questions and all kinds of good stuff. So.
Yeah, we always want to talk to you guys. Don't forget to like the Facebook page because that gives you access to more information. And also, once you like the Facebook page, hit us up on our timeline. Post pictures if you want. Post questions. We do have the ability and power, since it's our page, to get rid of crap that we don't want to see. Or if you guys start debating about petty bullshit, yes, I'm saying it like that. Petty bullshit will get deleted. But if you want to be part of the podcast, you know, craze, the Paranormal Pulse podcast craze, and a fan, and ask us questions and be part of the conversation, then by all means, please post on our Facebook page.
And
is
also,
that too harsh? I don't think that was harsh.
No. And I just have one last plug. For people who don't know of my photography, you can go to one of my webpages, which is www.modelmayhem.com. LR Photo Design Works, all one. So again, it's www.modelmayhem.com/LR Photo Design Works, all one word. And you can see my photography work there. You can see my profile and my portfolio, and you can see all the work I do with the beautiful models.
If you take it off of work mode, don't be at work.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all I'm saying. There's a work mode on Model Mayhem that won't post all of your photos.
Right. It's a work safe mode that will block out.
If you unclick work safe, then don't view it at work because we don't want anybody getting in trouble. It's art. It's beautiful, but some people have problems with that. So
right. So but yeah,
just
you can
a fair warning.
Yep. So you can check out my photography work there. There's a lot of stuff
I'm not going to do a shameless plug, although I don't blame you because, you know, it reaches a lot of people. If you want to know anything about me, just go to my page or go to the Paranormal Pulse podcast page and find me.
There you go.
Simple as that.
All right, folks.
Yeah, I'm Chris Bruno. Thanks for listening to the Paranormal Pulse podcast episode 20. It was a good time. I'll see you for number 21. You're up.
All right, folks. It's October. Have fun with it. And enjoy this episode, and we'll see you on the next one. Thanks for listening.
Yay.
The Paranormal Pulse. Like us on Facebook at East Coast Ghost. That's East Coast with a K. Ghost on Facebook. And feel it for yourself.